This free program is paid for by the listener members of KPFT Houston. If you're not already a member, think about joining with us to help keep free speech alive.
At 90.1 FM, this is KPFT in Houston. And now, Houston's only primetime radio program dedicated to news and concerns of the lesbi, gay, and transgender identity. This is Queer Voices.
Good evening on a nice spring night here in Houston. Tonight on Queer Voices, we're going to have David Elliott talk about Inside and Beyond the Beltway, his regular segment. Also, we're going to be talking about the elections, the upcoming elections tomorrow, with Marie Gonzalez and Garnett Coleman. Then, Glenn's going to do an interview with the Lone Star Volleyball upcoming pageant and tournament. All that's coming on, and of course, Joan is going to do an interview. And then, of course, we'll talk about the academies a bit. But first, we go to London and the BBC World News.
BBC News with Jim Lee. The right of women in the United States to have abortions is being challenged by the state of South Dakota. Governor Michael Rounds has signed a law that will ban almost all abortions, even in cases of rape or incest, and provides for 5-year jail sentences for doctors who perform them. The only exception would be if a pregnant woman's life was at risk. Supporters of the bill say it's intended as a direct assault on the US Supreme Court's landmark ruling of 1973, which guaranteed American abortion rights. Pro-abortion campaigners are expected to challenge the ruling, but a leading anti-abortion campaigner, Troy Newman, welcomed it.
This is representative of a sweeping movement that is taking place in America right now, from the grassroots, kind of moving from the ground up. And it's showing the legislators that the American people are not tolerating abortion any longer, and they want to save the babies that are being killed every day in the abortion clinics.
A court hearing has begun that will pass sentence on the only man charged in the United States with direct responsibility for the September the 11th attacks on Washington and New York. Zacharias Massaoui, a French citizen of Moroccan origin, has pleaded guilty to conspiring with Al-Qaeda to hijack aircraft. He faces either life imprisonment or the death sentence. The prosecution told the court in Virginia that Mr. Massaoui was an unrepentant terrorist whose lies had allowed the plot to continue unimpeded. But defense lawyers argued that Mr. Massaoui was an inconsequential figure, and sentencing him to death would make him appear a hero. The United States Treasury Secretary John Snow has asked Congress to allow the Bush administration to borrow more money in the financial markets. Any move by a U.S. government to borrow money requires congressional approval, and the current total accumulated debt is now close to the current ceiling of just below $8.2 trillion. With more details, here's our economics correspondent, Andrew Walker.
Mr. Snow has written to members of Congress saying that he has already taken what he called all prudent and legal actions to avoid reaching the debt limit. He has, for example, made use of civil service pension funds to reduce the amount the government has to borrow. What is urgently required now, he says, is an increase in the debt limit. As the US government borrows money in most years, total debt is usually rising, and Congress sometimes uses its authority to try to influence government policy. On this occasion, there are Democratic Party members of Congress who want to highlight the Bush administration's tax cuts, which they say gave too much to people with high incomes while undermining the government's finances.
You're listening to the news from the BBC. The first working session of the new Palestinian parliament has ended in turmoil after the militant group Hamas used its controlling majority to overturn measures adopted by the last session of the previous assembly. These included the allocation of key administrative posts to members of the rival Fatah party and wider powers for the Palestinian president Mahmoud Abbas. Fatah members of parliament walked out in protest, insisting Hamas had no right to revoke those decisions. The Israeli military has carried out an airstrike over Gaza City, killing 5 people. A missile, thought to have been fired from a pilotless drone aircraft, destroyed a vehicle carrying 2 members of the Islamic Jihad organization. The highest administrative body in France has upheld an order that Sikhs must be photographed without their turbans when they apply for driving licenses. The Council of State ruling also applies to photographs on French identity cards. Lawyers for the French Sikh who brought the case says he's considering an appeal. Reporting from Paris, Alistair Sanford.
Shingara Man Singh, who lives in the northern Paris suburbs, was seeking to overturn a circular from the French Transport Ministry insisting that bare heads be shown in driving license photos. In 2004, he was refused a duplicate license because he refused to take off his turban. In December, the Council of State ruled in Mr. Singh's favour on a technicality, but didn't say whether he had the right to wear the turban or not. This time, it ruled the ban was not an obstruction to freedom of religion, arguing that restrictions could apply in the interests of security and public order.
At least 45 African migrants have died at sea while they were trying to reach the Spanish Canary Islands. They drowned in two separate accidents off the coast of West Africa between Saturday night and Monday morning. 23 lost their lives when their open boat broke in two after colliding with a Moroccan vessel which had come to assist it. Another 22 drowned when their boat capsized. Thousands of African migrants undertake hazardous journeys to Europe each year to escape poverty, but many die in the attempt. A film about one of thousands of women who were raped and humiliated during the Bosnian War has been screened in Serbia. The movie, Grbavica, which won a top prize at the Berlin Film Festival last month, focuses on the plight of a Muslim woman who was held captive in a Serb rape camp in the early 1990s. BBC News.
This is Queer Voices.
Good evening, I'm Jack Polinsky.
And J.D. Doyle.
I'm Deborah Bell.
And I'm Glenn Holt.
This evening we have a number of things on our show, including shortly we'll be talking to David Elliott, but later on we're going to be talking about tomorrow's election with Maria Gonzalez, who's president of the Houston Gay, Lesbian, Bisexual, Transgender Political Caucus, and Garnett Coleman's going to call in. He's running for District 147. I should know that.
147, very good.
Which is the east side of Montrose and in the Benz area and downtown. And then Glenn's going to be talking to the people from the Lone Star Volleyball, their upcoming pageant and tournament. And then we have a few other things going on, including Joan Devlin doing an interview with Gerald Clark, author of the definitive Capote interview. And that ought to be real interesting. I actually went and saw that film again last Friday. And we're going to be talking about the academies in the second hour because there's a lot to talk about.
Right. His book, Capote, is the book that the film was based on.
Which is an excellent film. And yeah, it was really very much the gay academies in so many ways. David is with us now. And I want to say good evening to you. And I'm sure you've been following I know this is not what you were planning to talk about, David, but Supreme Court made a decision today.
Well, that's true, Jack. And the decision was disappointing, but it wasn't really surprising. We knew we were going to lose this one. We just didn't know what the margin was going to be. And as it turns out, the Supreme Court ruled 9-0.
8-0.
8-0. I stand corrected. You're correct. That military recruiters, who of course have to follow the military's don't ask, don't tell anti-gay policy, are allowed to recruit on college campuses that accept federal dollars, which is of course all of them virtually.
Yes, well, I guess there's ways to sort of work around it and still educate students about how discriminatory the Department of War is.
Absolutely, absolutely. But let's talk about the election.
Yes, we certainly have some exciting things going on here in Texas, but I think you were going to talk about some other areas.
Well, I was actually going to talk about the two congressional primary races that are happening in Texas that we in Washington, D.C. are keeping a very close eye on. And the first race is within the listening area of Queer Voices, and that race is the Republican primary, in which three Republican challengers are seeking to upset beleaguered incumbent Congressman Tom DeLay. Now, the leading challenger is Tom Campbell, who sort of bills himself as a clean Tom DeLay. He's conservative, but without all the ethics baggage. And he's been running a campaign based on the need for ethics in government. He's been appearing in TV spots and radio spots in the 22nd Congressional District, which takes in, I believe, a small part of Harris County, and I want to say all of Fort Bend County. Correct me if I'm wrong.
Well, it takes in also the Space Center
The Space Center,
and
correct.
It's sort of, I guess, hugs around the outside of Beltway 8, which is basically just outside Harris County.
Right. Now, what's really interesting about this race, Jack, is that Tom DeLay has not been running any TV or radio, but he's invested heavily in what's known as a ground game, using sophisticated techniques to try to identify his supporters and make sure they get to the polls. And the fact that DeLay is not using paid media has led to speculation that he is trying to avoid publicizing the race to such an extent that angry Democrats will come out to the polls and vote in the Republican primary in order to defeat him, which, of course, in Texas, you can have crossover voting. Democrats can vote in the Republican primary and vice versa. And in order to avoid a runoff, DeLay needs to capture 50% of the votes cast in tomorrow's primary. And the betting here is that he will manage to do that, but that the margin will be closer than many anticipate. I'm predicting something in the mid-50s. And that could serve as a catalyst for the campaign of Democrat Nick Lamson, who faces no primary opposition tomorrow, and according to one poll, leads Tom DeLay in this slightly Republican district by 8 percentage points, which is pretty amazing if you think about it.
It is, definitely.
Now, Jack, there's one other race that's attracting national attention up here inside the Beltway, as they say, and that involves incumbent Democratic Congressman Henry Cuellar in Congressional District 28. District 28 stretches from part of San Antonio in Bexar County down to Webb County in the Rio Grande Valley. And here in this district, history really could possibly be made tomorrow. Cuellar is what some people call a dino, or Democrat in name only. He campaigned for George W. Bush when Bush ran for president in 2000. He has a very conservative voting record, and he has supported much of the Republican Party's agenda during the last 6 years. And earlier this year, on the night that President Bush gave his State of the Union address, Cuellar was pictured being embraced by President Bush as the president made his way through the congressional chamber. Now, what happened after that is kind of interesting. That one photograph showing the two spread like wildfire through the blogosphere and has helped ignite the candidacy of challenger Ciro Rodriguez, another Democrat. As a result, Rodriguez has raised more than $500,000 since January 1st and has garnered the endorsement of labor unions and environmental groups. A group called the Change to Win Coalition is running radio ads in the district that attack Cuellar for campaigning with Bush, voting for a trade deal that puts thousands of our jobs at risk, and voting to give tax breaks to millionaires. And the League of Conservation Voters is running a similar line of attack against Cuellar in TV and radio ads in Laredo. And the tagline of their spot is, "Henry Cuellar sold you out. Vote to stop him." Now, because there's a third candidate in the race, Victor Morales, there's a very real possibility that tomorrow's contest will lead to a runoff election in April. If, however, Rodriguez upsets Cuellar, and I'm going to go out on a limb and predict that he will, it could be a sign that the net roots, or the grassroots, of if you will, of the Democratic Party, those tens of thousands of Democrats who are cyber activists and who are organizing over the Internet, are in full revolt and are no longer going to accept business as usual from Congress or from the Democratic Party. And, Jack, those are the two races we're really looking at in Texas tomorrow.
Well, it is interesting. Certainly the DeLay race has made national attention. It was in the Times today. It was on NPR recently. And it was interesting. Channel 13, the big local station here, did also a story, and DeLay would not talk to them, which is pretty interesting. You know, a candidate not talking to the biggest TV station in town. And we're going to be talking about some other local races, but I do think it's rather interesting. It's also rather interesting that people will still vote for him, even though he's been indicted. They don't necessarily like him, but they're afraid that they'll lose some of the perks that they get by having him in office.
Well, Jack, and he's running a very interesting campaign. And keep in mind that in that district, it's probably going to be a fairly low turnout election tomorrow. And he's got the best consultants that money can buy.
I'm sure.
They
yeah.
know the Republican primary. And they do things like, and the Republicans have gotten really good at this in recent years. They have a checklist of consumer behavior. For example, are you a member of the National Rifle Association? Do you drive an SUV? Do you attend a certain church on Sunday? There are a lot of questions they ask that help them identify who is a likely conservative Republican primary voter. And then once they've identified that relatively small universe of people, they put into place a program to make sure that that population gets to the polls.
Right.
It's a strategy
right.
based on having a pretty low turnout, but having 100% of your base show up for the polls.
Well, they are brilliant in the stuff that they do. I mean, you know, look at how they attack Kerry on his war history, you know,
sure.
record. And Tom DeLay is a genius. Well, or his people. I don't know exactly who is the genius behind doing so much of the stuff they did. It's also interesting that just recently the Supreme Court was looking at the redistricting in Texas, and they had the hearings, the arguments.
Right. And in fact, I followed that pretty closely, Jack, and I think the result of the argument, and we'll, by the way, we'll get an opinion probably in June, maybe early July. I think the result is that overall the Texas redistricting plan is going to be upheld. However, I think that three congressional districts, none in the Houston area, two in the Rio Grande Valley, and one coming up and touching Austin, and then another in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, could be tossed out and new primary elections ordered for those districts in the fall. So that's something to keep an eye on.
Interesting. Well, and there's one district, District 10, I believe, that actually stretches from the outskirts of Houston to the outskirts of Austin. And then there's a number of, as we know, in Austin, where they broke up the district so that Doggett, where they're trying to get him out, but they were called Bacon districts because they're so long and narrow.
Right. The joke is that you could drive through them in your car, and if you open up your car doors, you'll knock down everybody living in the district.
Exactly. Well, are there any other elections tomorrow around the country?
Actually, I don't know of any other elections going on tomorrow, Jack. I think that Texas is the only state having significant primaries tomorrow.
Well, and I know there's one coming up in Pennsylvania. I don't know the exact date, but certainly Santorum seems to be in a whole bunch of trouble. Maybe not for the primary, but definitely for the general election.
Sure, and there's another race to keep an eye on. The special election is in April. It's a congressional seat out in California caused by the vacancy of former Congressman Duke Cunningham,
yes.
who is on his way to prison for accepting bribes. And the Democrat in that race, her name escapes me at the moment. It's a district that leans Republican, but the Democrat is putting on a very strong, spirited campaign. And the reason why it's kind of important to keep an eye on this race is because of what I call the canary in the minefield syndrome. You know, you send the canary down into the mine, and if the canary dies, you know that the air is not safe to breathe. Well, if the Republicans lose the special election in April, then it could be a sign that they're really in trouble come November. And I should add, Jack, we have had 10 special elections, special legislative elections around the country so far this year, and the Democrats are 8-2.
Wow.
And the only two losses came in the most conservative district in the entire state of Missouri, where Democrats lost by a tenth of a percentage point.
Wow.
And then another loss came last week in a Republican district in the suburbs of Dallas. It was a special special election for the state house, state legislature, and the Democrat lost by some 400 votes. I should add that in a Republican-leaning district in Austin last week, a district that encompasses much of northwest Austin and Westlake Hills, a very Republican area, the Democrat won pretty strongly with something like 54% of the vote, despite being outspent 6-1.
Wow.
So the Democrats are getting up every morning and they're driving around the block to their polling precinct just to make sure that an election isn't going on that
yes.
no one bothered to tell
yes.
them about. The base is fired up. People are going to turn out. People are keenly aware, keenly tuned into the elections this year, and that could only be good news.
Well, and it's always good news if people are knowing when the elections are and they show up, not just for the presidential elections, but for all of them.
Absolutely, absolutely. And Jack, before I leave you, can I offer you something something kind of from the lighter side of things?
Sure.
Well, in Ohio, a state senator, a Democratic state senator, has filed a bill that would ban Republicans
yes.
from adopting children.
It's about time.
The guy's name is State Senator Robert Hagan, and he says that credible research shows that adopted children raised in Republican households are more at risk for developing emotional problems, social stigmas, inflated egos, an alarming lack of tolerance for others they deem different from themselves, and an air of overconfidence to mask their insecurities.
I had read this and I didn't know it was actually true.
It is, and of course it's very tongue-in-cheek, but the reason that he filed it was in response to Republican-backed legislation that would ban gays and lesbians in the state of Ohio from adopting.
Right. Well, and some people have said that this is going to be their next issue. As they push down around the, you know, no marriage for gays, now they're going to go after adoption.
Well, you know, they did it successfully in Florida, and now they're trying it in Ohio, and it kind of leads one to ask, what is it about Ohio and Florida? I mean, there's always trouble brewing, you know?
Yeah.
As we all know, they've got lots of problems with their voting machines.
Well, they had to fix them.
Lots of dead white people who vote and lots of living black people who aren't allowed to.
Exactly.
But now they have something else in common, the irrational and probably insincere fear of gay adoption.
Yes. Well, David, what do you do for your day job?
Well, Jack, for my day job, I'm the communications director for the National Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty. You can find our website at www.ncadp.org. Again, that's ncadp.org.
Well, David Elliott joins us on the first Monday of every month to bring us sort of a national perspective of what's going on. David, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, and good evening.
And you're listening to Queer Voices.
Welcome to This Way Out, the International Gay and Lesbian Radio Magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. The mayor's threat to quash Moscow Pride outrages activists across Europe. Felicity is spirited and Oscar embraces Brokeback's direction, words, and music, and exposing the sordid lives of a Southern Baptist sissy. All that and more this week, now that you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Sherry Lund.
And I'm Charles Hall.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting the lesbian and gay community for the week ending March 4th, 2006. Demonstrations are being held across Europe to protest the ban on a queer pride celebration in Moscow. Mayor Yuri Luzhkov said late last month that the city government would not allow such an event to take place in any form and that any attempt to hold it will be resolutely quashed. He announced the ban after several religious leaders in Moscow issued threats of disruption and physical violence because they were morally opposed to anything publicly queer positive in the city. Luzhkov's mayoral counterparts in London, Berlin, and Paris, the latter two of whom are gay men, have called on him to lift the ban. Queer activists gathered this week in front of Russian embassies in London, Paris, Warsaw, Stockholm, and Vienna to express their displeasure. In London, and with characteristic verve, Peter Tatchell of the queer human rights group Outrage asked, "Who does Lushkov think he is, Joseph Stalin? Russia is now a democracy, and in a democracy, people have a right to protest peacefully." The Stockholm demonstration was covered live on local and national radio and reported in morning newspapers the next day. More protests in Europe are reportedly in the works. Moscow Pride organizers said they intend to continue planning the event and are considering legal action, taking their case all the way to the European Court of Human Rights in Strasbourg if necessary. The Pride Parade is scheduled to take place on May 27th, the anniversary of the 1993 abolition of Soviet-era laws against male homosexuality.
Another round of queer bishop bombshells is set to blitz the already wobbly Anglican Communion with the news that a gay man and a lesbian are among five nominees to lead the Episcopal Diocese of California. Conservatives are calling the nominating committee selection of the Reverend Bonnie Perry of Chicago and the very Reverend Robert Taylor of Seattle an act of open defiance against the worldwide church's call for a moratorium on the ordination of openly lesbian and gay bishops. That request was issued in an effort to shore up the schism created by the 2003 consecration of the Reverend V. Gene Robinson as Bishop of New Hampshire. The diocesan election in the Bay Area is May 6th.
Meanwhile, the Anglican Province of Central Africa's Confirmation Court has refused to consecrate gay-supportive West London vicar Nicholas Henderson as bishop of the Diocese of Lake Malawi. Henderson is popular among the people because of his previous work in Malawi launching a variety of development programs. His supporters carried him on their shoulders during a private visit this week and then blockaded Archbishop Bernard Malongo's headquarters in protest of the rejection. Malongo said Henderson was deemed not of sound faith and that the decision was irreversible.
A new lesbian-gay organization may be the first to go public in Hanoi. According to a report this week in Than Yen News, Hai Dang, or Lighthouse, was created by the Hanoi-based Center for HIV, AIDS, and Sexually Transmitted Disease Prevention and is being funded by Family Health International. The group, which currently numbers about 25, wants to raise the public consciousness of homosexuality in Vietnam. It's time to change our views on the issue as we are in need of both understanding and support from the community, said Phan-Ting Nha, the group's director. Aside from overcoming resistance from government authorities, Nga said the most difficult obstacle came from the lesbian gay community itself. The center's social workers scouted Hanoi's well-known gay-frequented clubs, but many were reluctant to join, saying they were afraid to hurt their families if their membership in Hai Dang became known. The group's initial plans include educational and social meetings and outings for its members and the creation of a website. Nga said he expects to develop similar associations in other metropolitan areas, such as Ho Chi Minh City in the country's south.
Homosexuality was considered a mental disorder in China until 2001. A leading sociologist there this week submitted a measure to the annual session of the country's top political advisory body, the National Committee of the Chinese People's Political Consultative Conference, to legalize same-gender marriage. A member of that body's advisory board, Li Yinhe, is a well-known expert on marriage and sex studies with the Chinese Academy of Social Sciences. She was to deliver a keynote speech at a queer cultural festival last year that was raided by police and shut down. Li said she wants to end discrimination against gay men in China, estimated by a government survey in late 2004 to number between 5 and 10 million, which some experts have said could be much higher. The number of lesbians in China remains unclear. The measure introduced by Li this week must gain the support of at least 30 of the 2,000-member parliamentary body, which it's failed to do on two previous occasions. Li said that same-gender marriage creates stable relationships and makes safer sex more likely, helping to rein in the spread of HIV and AIDS. But she admits that the cultural environment in the country is not yet prepared for such a proposal.
More than 1,000 queer couples have wed in Spain since legal marriage equality came into force there last year. The figure was provided at a press conference this week by Pedro Zarolo, an openly gay member of the National Board of the Spanish Socialist Workers' Party, one of the main backers of the law. He said 800 same-gender marriages had officially been performed, but the figure came from only about half the country's civil registries, those fully computerized. As of today, he said, there should be more than 1,000 same-sex couples married and about the same number of applications going through. Zarolo married his partner, Jesus Santos, in October. Despite vocal and ongoing opposition from the once more dominant Roman Catholic Church, some 57% of Spaniards support marriage equality.
Scotland has seen at least three gay or lesbian unions a day since the United Kingdom's Civil Partnership Act took effect on December 21st, according to a mid-February report in the Scotsman newspaper, which called the figure astonishing. The largest numbers of ceremonies have taken place in Edinburgh and Glasgow.
And figures released last week by the Office for National Statistics counted 3,648 registered same-gender partnerships in England and Wales as of January 31st. Brighton and Hove was the most popular registration site. According to several reports, gay men in the UK have tied the knot at a rate more than double that of lesbians during the first few weeks since they became legal.
A U.S. lesbian minister's conscience and sense of calling absolved her of any guilt for officiating at two same-gender weddings, according to a 6-1 ruling by a regional tribunal of the Presbyterian Church USA. The Reverend Jane Spar of San Rafael, California, had been charged with misconduct for violating the denomination's constitutional definition of marriage as a covenant between a man and a woman. A national-level church court decision in 2000 found that gay and lesbian unions could be blessed as long as the ceremonies did not mimic and the relationships were not equated to heterosexual marriage. However, Spar said at her trial that her personal vocation as an equal rights advocate aside, the couple's wishes were of prime importance to her. "They said marriage," she testified, "and I was honored to do their marriage so they would not be seen as second class in any way." In his summation, defense attorney Timothy Kahn said, "If it's an offense to believe or to determine in our hearts that these two young couples are married, charge me, because I believe it and I will pronounce it." The majority of the judicial panel wrote that the section of the Constitution in question was a definition, not a directive, and found that Spar was acting within her right of conscience. They also noted that Spar's views were consistent with the normative standards of their Northern California Presbytery and affirmed the Bible's message of inclusiveness, reconciliation, and the breaking down of barriers that separate humans from each other. Some Presbytery leaders had indicated that the costly proceeding had been essentially forced by the complaint of a minister from outside the area, so it's not known whether they will appeal the ruling.
Wisconsin has become the seventh U.S. state to place a constitutional amendment on the ballot banning legal recognition of gay and lesbian couples. The proposal, overwhelmingly approved in the state legislature this week, outlaws any legal status identical or substantially similar to that of marriage for unmarried individuals. Alabama voters will decide on a constitutional marriage ban in June, while November referendums will take place in Tennessee, South Carolina, South Dakota, Virginia, Idaho, and now Wisconsin. Petition drives are underway in Arizona and Colorado, while equality opponents in several other states are targeting 2007 or 2008. Voters in 19 U.S. states have thus far approved constitutional bans on same-gender unions, most recently in November by a 76% margin in Texas.
And finally, in response to yet another attack on lesbians and gay men in a U.S. state legislature, and the specifics of the anti-queer legislation in this case aren't important, Utah's only openly gay lawmaker, Scott McCoy, this week eloquently defined the real gay agenda on the floor of the state Senate.
Whether or not this passes, gay and lesbian people are going to be in the state of Utah, we're going to be in the high schools, we're going to have families, and we're going to be raising them here. And I would simply ask that you allow us to do that and leave us alone.
That's News Wrap for the week ending March 4th, 2006. Follow the news in your area. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap was written this week by Lucia Chappelle and Greg Gordon and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles. For This Way Out, I'm Sherry Lund.
And I'm Charles Hall.
This is Queer Voices.
Well, it's election time again. It seems like every time you turn around here in Texas, we have another election coming up. This time, it is the primary races for both the Democrat and Republican Party, and the other parties will be, or independents, will be chosen or selected later.
And state races.
State races. Well, state and and U.S. races.
National, yes.
National license. So it is...
As opposed to city. I think last time we were having an election, it was city.
Well, but we also have some county judges up, too.
Excellent. And we also have a raise in the minimum wage on the ballot.
Yes, but I don't think that's binding since it's on a... I'd be interested if that same question's on a Republican...
Binding or not, it would be... It becomes part of our party platforms.
And I know we're not even trying to argue here, but it'd be interesting to know if it was also on the Republican primary question.
Maria Gonzalez says no.
Hi, y'all.
Maria Gonzalez is president of the Houston Gay, Lesbian, Transgendered, and Bisexual Political Caucus, and she's joining us this evening so that Deborah and I don't get into an argument, which is so hard.
And GLBT Political Caucus PAC, Political Action Committee, makes endorsements in contested races. So, such as our excellent candidate Ellen Cohen, who thankfully does not have an opponent in the primary, is not endorsed, but
that's only because
she doesn't have an opponent.
And that's, at this point, we're not addressing those issues. We're concentrating on contested races in, unfortunately, the Democratic primary, simply because when we've invited candidates from the Republican side to screen with us, they've, for the majority, have politely said no, thank you. One or two were needed... some happy pills in them. They responded with some ugly no's, but overall, we only endorse for the primary in contested races. We invite all the candidates we can get a hold of to seek our endorsement. And those who show interest, we get back with them, we call them up, and those who say, yes, I am interested, we send them a questionnaire. We then ask them to fill it out. We invite them for an interview. We schedule the interview. We set up panels. We score them. We present them to our membership. This time we presented them to our February 1st general meeting. We had a PAC meeting. We had endless discussion, and we came out with seven candidates that we have endorsed in seven different races.
Well, and before we get to that, I do want, under full disclosure, say that I serve on the board of the caucus. Deborah's a member, we have one of the people who is running on the phone with us, Garnett Coleman, who's running for District 147. Welcome, Garnett.
Thanks, Jack. It's great to be on.
Well, and for probably the first time in a while, you actually have opposition in the primary?
That's right. I've served in the Texas House since 1991, and the last time I had a primary opponent was in 1996.
Yeah, and that's one of the reasons why we screened and endorsed Garnett Coleman, the caucus did, because for the first time in 10 years, he actually has a primary opponent.
Well, and Garnett, you certainly worked very hard in Austin during the past session and during the special sessions. Tell us a little bit about your background.
Well, I was born in Washington, D.C. I'm sorry, I can't claim Texas birth.
Neither can
I. My father was in school there, and I've lived here in Houston since I was 10 months old. I'm from Third Ward, lived there my whole life except for those 10 months. I went to Howard University in Washington, D.C., and I completed my education at the University of St. Thomas in political science. My time in the legislature, I've served on the Public Health Committee since 1993. I served on the Appropriations Committee from 1993 till 2001, and I currently serve on both the Public Health Committee and the County Affairs Committee. Some people say arguably, and that's probably right, the area that I have expertise in is health and human service finance and health policy, as well as economic development and special district policy on the that creates special districts on the local level. And I've learned a lot about education and a lot of other things, but those are the things that I've tended to concentrate over the last 14 years. Since 2003, though, I have chaired the what's better known as the Progressive Caucus, but it's called the Legislative Study Group. We have about 40 members, and our job is to work on behalf of Texas families and their needs and make sure that progressive agenda is protected and forwarded in Texas. And so we've had our hands full, but we've been working really hard under the Tom Craddock era.
Well, yes, I mean, definitely, and I understand that some of the national money isn't coming through because Texas is not matching it, and some of the national money would be matched like 2-1 or 3-1.
That's correct. If those of you have heard of the Children's Health Insurance Program, and it's actually $2.59 to each dollar spent by the state. The feds send us $2.59. And unfortunately, this group of people doesn't believe hardworking families should have assistance for their children with health coverage, so they cut 200,000 children off of the Children's Health Insurance Program, and as a consequence, we left $500 million on the table, and states like Wisconsin, New York, and California got our federal allocation.
Right, and it ends up costing more because they end up in the public hospitals.
You got it. These the folks who don't have health insurance go to Ben Taub, they go to LBJ and the same public hospitals and nonprofit hospitals across the state. But in the public hospitals, it's still paid for through ad valorem or property taxes, and because of that, it is the least fiscally responsible way to deal with illness. So with illnesses, you do preventative health care and interventive health care, so you don't treat people in an emergency room. But it seems like these folks are penny-wise, well, I'd say penny-cheap and pound-foolish, because ultimately the cost both in dollars and to society is higher. And Maria, you know that with people who have any kind of illness, without health insurance, it's really a real challenge, even now with health insurance, to maintain that illness or even just go see a doctor.
Well, and that's one of the reasons why Garnet is our top candidate. The caucus is endorsing Garnet because he supports progressive issues, and he's one of the few who's fighting the Craddock right wing. It targets the gay community, targets children, targets education to wipe us all off the face of the earth. And that's why Garnet has opponents, in fact, in this primary. It's simply because he's effective, he challenges the leadership, and they were trying to send him and us in Houston a message that Garnet is vulnerable, that they can make his life miserable. And what we're trying to do is also send a message out that you don't mess with people who support us.
And let me just say that I'm so appreciative and proud of the support of the caucus and of the community. And, you know, it goes without saying that it's very important that we all stick together, and it's important that people go out to vote tomorrow. But it's also important that we stick to our principles and equality in Texas for all citizens, for all people, regardless of their sexual orientation is important for me. I was the author after Harriet Earhart left the legislature in Dallas of the Dignity for All Students Act to stop bullying of all students, but particularly students of that are GLBT students. And we worked very hard to stop HGR6, the anti love and gay couple amendment, and worked hard, unfortunately failed at the ballot box to defeat it, but we haven't stopped working on those issues, and I won't stop working on those issues. It worked really hard to defeat the amendment that Robert Talton had that would have prevented gay and lesbian couples from serving as foster parents.
Right, and I mean, now that they've got the marriage thing on the in the Constitution, they're going to go after adopting and foster parents.
That's right, and we have to be vigilant because this is not uncommon in other states, just like you said, and it's never over. And these folks don't sleep, and a lot of people think they're dumb, but they're not. They're very smart. And they get up early and they stay up late, and they work very hard to accomplish their agenda. But we have to be in their way. And I think what surprised them really is how much we have been in their way and pointing out their contradictions and hypocrisy and their cronyism, their lies, in their abuse of state and national government.
Garnet, can you talk a little bit about that? I mean, it's like they live in another planet. They don't hear from, is it that they don't hear from us, or what's going on there?
Well, and actually this morning, Cokie Roberts said on NPR that basically this line item veto that Bush wants now is basically a diversionary device.
I'm sure that's right. I mean, look, it comes down to this. That in their world, government is limited except from a social context. And then it's activist government. And to limit government and limit expenditures, you cap taxes. And when you cap taxes, you starve the public goods that we're used to, public education, assistance for the elderly and disabled and others, and children with medical care. A good public and higher education, those kinds of things. And then they want to go in and turn back the clock to pre-Franklin Roosevelt, quite frankly, and create an intolerant world that is based on a theocracy as opposed to a democracy. And that's what we've seen. And unfortunately, they're the masters at, look at my hand over here, but I'm really putting something in my pocket over there. And as they cut services, they contract those same services out to their friends.
Right, right.
And that's, so they're making money through cronyism off of the government, claiming they don't want money. These are not cheap people. They love money. Be clear about that. But they also want the world to be in their image. And it doesn't include women. It does, unless it's subservient to the man under a fundamentalist doctrine. It does not include poor people or people of color. It does not include gays, lesbians, bisexual, and transgender people. It does include people who want their tax dollars to go to assist individuals. It doesn't include progressive people. And really, what they want to do is get rid of that and create what they call the permanent majority. And that permanent majority would continue to, both in social policy and in fiscal policy, clamp down on those groups that I mentioned. And that, I tell you, in 2003 and 2005, it was an all-out attack, and it's going to continue. And the new attack, you know it, you've heard it, is on immigrants. And we know what that means. That means Mexicans, and that means terrorists, because they know how people visualize the word immigrant, and that's the new, you know, it's been, unfortunately, gays and lesbians. Now it's gays, lesbians, and immigrants. So I guess if you're a gay or lesbian immigrant, terrorist, you've got a hard time.
We're talking to Garnett Coleman, who is running for District 147 State Rep. And Garnett, thank you very much for joining us. And I know you got a long day tomorrow. You know, working the polls are open from 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. If you don't know where to vote, and we will repeat this later, you can go to just do Harris County Votes search on the web.
HarrisVotes.org.
And they will tell you, you can either put your address in there, your precinct number, because the Democratic and Republican primaries will very likely be in different places. And the fact that where you normally go to vote may not be the place where you go to vote tomorrow for the primary. Garnett, the best of luck.
Good luck, Garnett.
Thank you very much. Thank you for all of your support and the support of the caucus. That means a lot to me.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Welcome.
So that is one of the endorsed candidates. And of course, Garnett Coleman has been working for this community for a long time. But there are other people that are on the endorsement card.
Yeah. Let me just go through the list. There are seven names, seven races, even though there are a lot. You know, if you go and you vote in the Democratic primary, there are a whole lot of races, some contested. We did our best to contact these people, and some tried, and we just couldn't get the scheduling right for them to seek our endorsement. And then some people just seemed to have not noticed that we'd been trying to contact them. Anyway, for governor, the caucus PAC has endorsed Bob Gamage. At the Texas State Legislature, District 140, we have endorsed Kevin Bailey. In District 146, we have endorsed Al Bennett. In District 147, of course, Garnett Coleman, our hero. U.S. Representative, District 7, David Murph. U.S. Representative, District 10, Ted Ankrum. And Justice of the Peace, Precinct 2, Place 2, Zanetta Burney. These are really pro-GLBT supportive candidates who get our message, understand what we're fighting for, recognize that we are challenged, recognize that we are being targeted by different populations, specifically the Texas legislative right wing that Garnett Coleman is also being targeted by, and that these are our friends and these people will stand beside us.
And if you don't know what district you're in, you just get out your voter registration certificate. It's bright yellow right now, the current one, and it'll have over on the right-hand side above where your address is, your U.S. Rep district, your state Senate district, your state Rep district, your Commissioner's Precinct, and your Justice Precinct. And that information is also available at Harris Votes when you look up to where you're going to go vote. And take your certificate with you if you have it. And sometimes you're going to be asked for a picture ID as well, or it can be used instead of the certificate.
Right, and if you want this endorsement card, you can go to hglbtpc.org, and you can download it as a PDF file, print it out, and take it to your precinct polls with you. And this is for the Democratic runoff only in Texas. There has been no endorsements on the Republican side.
No, we invited, and they most of them politely turned us down.
You know,
so
I voted early, and I just noticed they didn't stamp my card as being Democrat.
Well, it'll be in the list.
Don't worry, the roster is very clear about that. One last thing. We will be doing some phone banking tomorrow. I wanted to put in a plug for that. Hope you all don't mind. From between 11 and 2, the caucus will be at the Community Center, 3400 Montrose, second floor. We're going to be calling voters and reminding them that there's a primary and they need to get out and vote. That's one of the big challenges. We're really worried there's going to be a real low turnout, and we're trying to get as many people out to vote. So if you're listening to this, please remind everybody at work tomorrow that they really need to get out there and vote in the primary.
Thank you, Maria. And
you're
listening. Maria Gonzalez is president of the Houston GLBT Political Caucus. Voting is open from 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. at your local precinct. You're listening to Queer Voices.
Turn down the dial. I don't want another listening to something I've had enough of. It's all the same, a big misconception. Thinking I'd find what I was looking for. Love is not just a fix anymore. A man needs to feel something more. So maybe it's time that I tear down the walls, open my eyes. I wanna know love and another life. There's gotta be more to this life. Let me know love and another life. Oh. Too many nights I fed from the ruin of manic pursuits that left nothing to gain. In desolate bars, drowning in whiskey, back rooms with boys that don't have a name. At some point we all want the same, to live and let go of the pain. So maybe it's time that I tear down the walls, open my eyes. I wanna
and happy ending begins. This is J.D. I'm very pleased to let you know that those two artists were Levi Christ and Eric Hyman. And I'm more pleased to let you know that they will both be in town this Thursday night at the Guava Lamp. And I complain a lot that quality gay entertainment does not come to Houston. Well, they're going to be here Thursday, and if you don't go, it's your own fault for not seeing them. In the last week's Voice, there's a big article about Levi talking about his acting, and he was on The Apprentice, and he was an XX gay, so there's lots for him, lots to read about, and they are great entertainers Thursday night at the Guava Lamp.
At 90.1 FM, this is KPFT Houston. Now, more of Queer Voices with Jack Valinsky, Joan Devlin, J.D. Doyle, and Glenn Holt.
Hey, sing if you're glad to be gay, sing if you're happy.
And this is Glenn Holt, and coming up this coming weekend, March 11th, at South Beach on Pacific Street, there is going to be, guess what, a drag show. Okay, now I know, yeah, everybody say, okay, all right, another drag show. But really, listen up, because there's a good reason for this. This is a fundraiser. It's not one of those, you know, big serious things with 10,000 contestants or whatever. We've just got, what, three or four contestants, and I have one of them in the studio with me, Miss Diana Fernandez. And yes, this is going to be a drag show, and one of the people actually isn't, like, do you call it drag if it's a female is doing it?
Yeah, I'm dressing up like a woman. Well, a man dressing up like a woman or something like that. I don't know. It's very, very confusing. Diana Fernandez is my real name, and I do actually have a drag name even. So it's
okay, what's
quite
that?
Fun. I'm Irika Fish, which is...
Irika Fish.
Yes, thank you to all of my gay friends that helped me come up with that one.
All right. Now, the whole organization behind... what's going to happen here on Saturday. What is that and why is that?
The organization behind it is actually a part of Lone Star Volleyball Association. It's the Lone Star Volleyball Classic. It is a tournament that is held every year by Lone Star Volleyball Association and in association with Lone Star Volleyball Association. It's Lone Star Volleyball Classic. It's our 17th year. We put on this pageant every year for a fundraising event where this year giving all of the money to AIDS Foundation Houston Camp Hope, which is a group that does kind of a charity camp for young kids between ages 6 and 15. And it works mostly, well, a lot on private donations such as ours. So we want to raise a lot of money, and this is part of it. And last year, we actually raised about $1,500 at this event. So it's quite a substantial amount of money that we, you know, that we hope to raise. And, you know, anyway.
So you mean that there's actually queer people in Houston that play volleyball?
Yes, there's a big, giant gay volleyball association. Actually, Lone Star Volleyball Classic is a sanctioned tournament from NAGVA, which is...
the North American Gay Volleyball Association.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. They every year, like I said, they have a tournament here in Houston over Easter weekend. This year, Easter falls on the 16th of April. So our tournament is actually on Good Friday and then the Saturday just before Easter so that we can all go out and...
how sinful.
I know, it's terrible. But it's great. It actually works out really well because we get to go to some of the other events, like, you know, Bunnies and Jungle and all that other fun stuff. So
what happens? That happens on the same weekend, doesn't it?
Yeah. Actually, okay. Jungle is on Saturday night, and they're one of our sponsors. So we're really excited about that. So
now Lone Star 17, which mm-hmm. is sort of the main event around which the pageant revolves.
Correct.
Is the 17th annual running of this big national tournament. And you have, well, actually, it's international because you have people coming in from, like, Puerto Rico.
Yeah. Actually, we had a team last year from San Juan, Puerto Rico. We actually, on my team, we had a San Juan player. So that was really neat. We have... you know, teams coming from all over the country. We have California. I think we had somebody last year from Maryland. Just all over the place. And, you know, it's one of the largest tournaments before we have nationals every year, this year being in Atlanta. So it's our nationals tournament is Memorial Day weekend, like I said, in Atlanta. So
And you can imagine if there's going to be a tournament with a whole bunch of gay people involved, that
cute
some of the
gay
costumes...
people. Cute gay people.
There
not,
you go.
Not ugly ones. They're in-shape boys
not
with
allowed.
Lots of muscles and hotness.
And some of the costumes can be pretty inventive.
Yeah. Actually, this year, it's kind of fun. We're having an 80s theme for Miss LSBA, so it will be more than interesting. And like I said, you know, it's the first year a girl's actually been, you know, asked to compete. I was actually asked, so I'm really excited to do it. But yeah, this is the first year that it's going to happen. We've got a couple of other guys that are really great. Alexis and Shafrika are the other two contestants. So we're really excited about it.
Actually, I was talking about the costumes at the volleyball tournament.
Oh, the volleyball tournament. Yeah, actually, we had a really great team from Dallas last year that we typically have a contest for best uniform and stuff like that. But they all came out dressed in like short Daisy Dukes with like you know, checked shirts and tied up in a knot, and they came out to the Dallas theme, of course, because they're from Dallas.
Oh,
they're
yeah.
all wearing wigs and hats, and it's quite interesting. So.
And somebody 1 year brought a great big huge Easter bunny in the head off to the side.
I remember that one.
Yeah, I've got a picture of it. And some other people did, like, the Pebbles and Bam Bam thing.
Right, yeah. Those are the Dallas Flintstones. They ended up getting best uniform this year. So it was really interesting. They had, like, orange shirts, and they put black dots all over it, and they cut them off, and they really look like Flintstones guys.
So... Now, back to the drag pageant, mm-hmm. which is a... Well, the whole thing is a fundraiser.
Yeah, it's...
But the drag pageant is a fundraiser for the fundraiser.
Right. It's what we call a charity pageant.
Oh, there you go. These are all charity cases.
Hey.
Okay, so now if you go to the current issue of Outsmart,
mm-hmm.
there's a picture in there of...
Of Miss Opal Essence. She is our reigning Miss LSBA. 2005 is how she likes to say it. Opal has been
and a good volleyball player.
Yeah, she's actually a great volleyball player, and fortunately we got you know, this great feature in Outsmart, and she looks phenomenal in it. I mean, and there's the crown that I'm going to win, by the way.
Okay.
on Saturday. So,
and she has big hair.
Big hair, and I'm being helped by Miss Opal with my hair, I hope.
And
I'm praying.
Now, this is going to be this coming Saturday, starting at 7 o'clock
yes.
in the evening.
Yes, it's at South Beach at 7 o'clock on March 11th. There's a $5 suggested donation at the door that will keep you in South Beach all night long. The pageant will last until about 10 o'clock.
I'm going to be there at the front door, so
yes.
y'all just give your cash to me.
Which he'll then give to me.
That's right.
They actually, you know, everything, like I said, all the money is going to be going to charity. So basically the big part of it is the contestant that gets the most money, give it to me, is most likely to be the winner. There are also two other contests. There are a question and answer section, and then there's a talent portion. And it's going to be interesting. Like
and
I said, 80s theme.
And so if you win Miss LSBA, what are you going to do with your title to change the world?
World peace.
There you go.
Always world peace. Can't go wrong with that.
Or world peace.
Or something
other.
Like that, yeah.
Yeah.
And the great thing about the whoever wins, even if it's not me, whoever it wins, we do have other you know, things that we do in the community throughout the year, and throughout Miss LSBA's reign, she gets to go and like be on the float in the parade, and then, you know, perform at our banquet after our tournament. So it's, you know, a lot of good fun stuff that we can use to also still raise money. So we continue to raise money for the community, for our beneficiary, or for our volleyball association, which is nonprofit. You know, so we can help do things for members and stuff like that. But you know, Miss LSBA gets to do other things too, other than, you know, just perform in one drag show. So
right, and that's a good segue into, I wanted to talk about who the beneficiary is.
Yes.
This Camp Hope.
Yes. It's AIDS Foundation Houston Camp Hope. Like I said, they raise money for a camp for children's age 6 to 15. Great, great, great charity. They've been doing it for a really long time. We actually got to hear a little bit from the gentleman in charge, Mark Cohen.
He's been on our show before.
Oh, yeah. He's so nice, so great.
And so well-spoken.
Yeah, he is, and he knows a lot about the charity. He knows a lot about the community. It's really great to know. But, you know, they used to actually bring... you know, they're bringing children in, I guess, from other cities and from around the world to get them into this camp. And, you know, we just want to raise money to, you know, get those people, get the kids that deserve those kind of things, you know.
And an important thing that Mark mentioned at the board meeting where he came and talked to us about it is that the children, or the parents of the children, are not required to put any money up for this.
Nope.
So
no, it's all free for the children, all free for the parents, transportation, everything. They get to go to this camp for free, and they probably would not have been able to go, you know, and it's a great, great thing for them to do. You know, last year, like I said, we raised about $7,500 for Aves, which was our beneficiary last year, and, you know, it's so greatly appreciated by these guys, and I love doing it. It's awesome.
So even if you don't play volleyball, here's your chance to participate in this fun event and help out with Camp Hope.
Yes.
Just come out this coming Saturday.
Yes.
Now, of course, if you do play volleyball, and you have a team, or you want to get a team together real quick,
right,
and you want to participate in the tournament, which is going to be held out at Willowbrook.
Willowbrook Sports Complex.
And if you're going to do this, you probably already know about LSVA and Willowbrook and so on. Mm-hmm. However, there's a website.
Yes, and it's www.lsva.org. And there's links to the Miss LSVA pageant up there. There's links to the Lone Star Volleyball Classic up there. Information on all kinds of things that you can do with volleyball. We have actually just started our spring 2006 season for Lone Star Volleyball Association. And, you know, we always welcome new members. We always welcome people to come out and sub. So if you do play volleyball, come out and play. You know, come out and check us out.
Yeah, and you don't have to be gay, bisexual, transgendered, or
drag queen.
Or whatever. Yeah, right. Just fabulous.
Just fabulous. That's right. No, we actually don't discriminate. Anybody who wants to play can play. We have three different divisions. We have the recreational division, the competitive division, and the power division. Recreational is probably a little bit more social. You just kind of come and meet people and just kind of play. And
it's a good place to learn.
Yeah, it's a great place to learn. I mean, it's a wonderful place that if you know kind of just basic skills that you can come out and just join a team and get on. Competitive is a little more obviously competitive. A little more structured teams that, you know, like to play a little harder and like to actually win points and, you know, and win games and win trophies and stuff like that. And then our power division is our upper level. Oh, yeah. They scare me. I actually played in that division last season and it scared me. No, they're more advanced players. They're really good players. You know, they've been playing for many, many years and they're awesome. So we love it. I mean, I've been playing now this is my sixth season. I think it's my sixth season, my third or fourth year. So I'm really
So if you
excited.
Want to get involved, it's still not too late. You can go to the website,
right,
which is again
LSVA, www.lsva.org.
Okay.
And I actually, if you have any questions and you don't want to go to the website, you just want to send out an email and get some questions, you can email me. I'm also the secretary of the league. You can email me at secretary@lsva.org. If you have any questions, you can certainly, I have no problem answering questions.
And if you just like to see a whole bunch of hot, cute, athletic, sexy young guys and gals playing volleyball in a tournament that's coming up Easter weekend.
Yes.
And
April 14th and 15th, that is Friday, Good Friday, and then the Saturday before Easter.
But don't forget about the pageant coming up this Saturday.
Yes, March 11th, 7 p.m., South Beach, $5 suggested donation as a cover. That'll get you in all night, and you don't have to leave. You can stay and party the night away at South Beach.
And your drag name again?
Irika Fish.
That's right. Okay.
Miss Irika Fish.
Miss Irika Fish, otherwise known as Diana Fernandez, the secretary of LSVA. I want to thank you for being on the program and telling us all about all of this stuff.
Thank you very much, Glenn. I appreciate it.
You're listening to Queer Voices.
Now, that was very nice. That was Luke Parkin from his album Winter Journal. And if you got the latest issue of Outsmart, there's a little mini review of that so you can read more about him.
This is Queer Voices.
Although another notable socially significant film crashed what was expected to be a Brokeback Mountain party for the Motion Picture Academy's best film of 2005, the heart-wrenching gay love story did add three major Oscars to its herd of trophies at the 78th Annual Hollywood Ceremonies on March 5th. And the night before that show watched round the world, Brokeback Mountain did win the prize for best feature at the Independent Spirit Awards, as did best director Ang Lee. Capote won the Spirit Award for Dan Futterman's Best Screenplay and Best Male Lead for Philip Seymour Hoffman, who, as expected, went on the next night to win the Oscar. Duncan Tucker won the Independent Spirit Best First Screenplay Trophy for Transamerica, and while she didn't win the top prize at the Oscars, Felicity Huffman's Star Turn won her the Spirit Award for Best Female Lead.
In true independent fashion, it was about 1 o'clock in the morning, and a 10K lamp blew out and sprayed glass all over everyone. And when we went to the truck to try and get a new lamp, we found that the driver had gotten drunk and run off to Mexico with the keys. I looked up and I saw our key grip Bob on a 14-foot ladder with a flashlight in his mouth trying to jerry-rig a light so we could continue shooting. And he was going, this movie better win some awards because it's a pain in the ass. So I want you to get out your pens and paper, and his name is Bob Izzo, and he's the best and coolest key grip. And we kept shooting thanks to him, and I just want to say, Bob, we won the award.
Brokeback Mountain collected Oscars the next night for Best Original Score Composer Gustavo Santaolalla.
I'm so proud to have worked in this movie, Brokeback Mountain, a movie that once again showed us that love is what makes us all very similar, in spite that we can be so different too. I want to thank my family, my wife Alejandra, my kids, Ana, Luna, and Don Juan, and last but not least, I want to dedicate this to my mother, a mi madre, to my country, Argentina, and to all the Latinos. Para todos los Latinos, muchas gracias. Thank you.
Best Adapted Screenplay for Larry McMurtry and Diana Ossana.
The duty of art is to send light into the darkness of men's hearts. Thank you, Annie Proulx. She's right over there, for trusting us with your brilliant short story. Thank you to Ang Lee and our brilliant cast for breathing life into our words.
And Best Director for Ang Lee.
First of all, I want to thank two people who don't even exist. Or I should say, they do exist because the imagination of Annie Proulx and the artistry of Larry McMurtry and Diana Ossana. Their names are Ennis and Jack. And they taught all of us who made Brokeback Mountain so much about not just all the gay men and women whose love is denied by society, but just as important, the greatness of love itself. And I just did this movie after my father passed away. More than any other, I made this for him. And finally, to my mother and family and everybody in Taiwan, Hong Kong, China, 谢谢大家的关心. Thank you.
It was a unique year for the Oscars, dominated by independent, relatively low-budget films dealing with politically charged issues, few of which have been box office blockbusters. In accepting his Best Supporting Actor Oscar for another one of those movies, Syriana, George Clooney couldn't resist commenting on conservative critics who claim that Hollywood is out of touch with mainstream culture.
I would say that, we are a little bit out of touch in Hollywood every once in a while. I think it's probably a good thing. We're the ones who talk about AIDS when it was just being whispered, and we talked about civil rights when it wasn't really popular, and we You know, we bring up subjects. We're the ones. This academy, this group of people gave Hattie McDaniel an Oscar in 1939 when blacks were still sitting in the backs of theaters. I'm proud to be a part of this academy. Proud to be part of the community. And proud to be out of touch.
That was Oscar winner George Clooney, and I'm Greg Gordon for This Way Out. Live theater to the silver screen to cable and network television, Del Shores has come a long way from his conservative roots, both personally and professionally. And that dual journey informs his work with a blend of honesty and hilarity. This Way Out's Steve Pride sat down with the prolific Shores for a discussion about real and fictional drama, Southern Baptists, and a wide variety of sissies.
48-year-old playwright and screenwriter Del Shores grew up in Texas, the son of a Southern Baptist preacher. His brother still lives in Texas and is a Southern Baptist preacher. Oscar Wilde once said, "To be understood is to be exposed." For Del Shores, that moment came in 1995 with the premiere of his fourth and most autobiographical play, a family dysfunction and gay coming out saga, Sordid Lives. Shores then married for 9 years and with two daughters, burst from the closet personally and professionally in a big way.
It's not something that I ever really wanted to be because I was told that it was a horrible thing to be. So I didn't want to be that horrible thing. So I knew I was attracted to guys at a very early age, like early teen, but I just pushed it away and I never dealt with it until I was in my 30s. Already married with two children. Then I came out of the closet and, you know, the hinges of the door just sort of shattered. I'm very proud and glad that I've dealt with it and happy, very happy now. We have such fears in our lives. And after I came out to my Southern Baptist preacher dad and my mom and the whole family, most fears went away because that was the scariest thing that I ever did. Because, I mean, you first of all, you face that fear of rejection, that you're not going to be a part of the family anymore. The one great thing about my mom, and when she passed away, I found all of these files where she had done so much research on my behalf about gay. She really wanted to be informed, and I wish that other people in my family would do that, because she wanted to know what it was about, and asking way too many questions. So I'm, you know, the first time I go home, it's like Christmas, I bring my daughters, they're 2 and 5 at the time, and my mother comes into my bedroom, and she says, "I need to ask you some questions." And I go, "Oh, okay." And she goes, "What is it exactly that you do?" And I'm like, "What?" And, you know, she goes, you know, gay stuff. What do you do? And I'm like, "Oh, my God. Mother, I am not going to talk to you about this. There are books you can read." And then so finally she just kept on, and I thought, okay, you know what? So I just basically looked at my lap and started explaining a lot of things. I left some things out. But, you know, that was the kind of mom she was. And then at the end of this conversation, she goes, "Well, the other day, your daddy and I were watching Sally, Jesse, Raphael, and..." She said, "Now, I don't mean to be ugly, but there were just a bunch of freaks on there. They were all kinds of people in transition. One was a man that used to be a woman. One was a woman. And then some of them had started hormone therapy." She said, "Now, you're not going down that road, are you?" "No, Mom, I'm really happy being a gay man. I want to stay just like that." And then there's that long pause, which, of course, I put in the movie Sordid Lives. She goes, "Well, are you the woman or the man?"
Del Shore's plays include Cheatin', Daughters of the Lone Star State, Southern Baptist Sissies, The Trials and Tribulations of a Trailer Trash Housewife, Daddy's Dying, Who's Got the Will, and Sordid Lives. The latter two were made into successful motion pictures, and the film version of Southern Baptist Sissies starts shooting in just a few months. But even if you've never seen one of his plays or films, you've still probably encountered his work as a writer on such TV shows as Queer as Folk, Dharma and Greg, Ned and Stacy, and even, oddly enough, Touched by an Angel.
I did one episode of Touched by an Angel. I did the Felicia Rashad alcoholic episode. And I got to tell you, I have made more residuals off of that one episode than probably I made doing one whole year of Ned and Stacy. It was a crazy thing. I wrote the fourth episode of the show, and they've novelized my episode. It's crazy. And so the next season, I actually was offered a job, and I chose Ned and Stacy over Touched by an Angel. And to this day, I think it was probably the biggest financial mistake of my career.
Del Shores is loved by most of the actors who've worked with him. Even his former in-laws remain close and regularly appear in his plays. But from his three-year gig writing Queer as Folk, there is one actor of which he is not particularly fond, Randy Harrison, who played Justin.
Randy was so ungrateful for being on the show, and he was always turning down press. And basically, by the end of the show, nobody wanted him to do press because he would trash the show that pretty much made his career. I hope you're listening, Randy. It's not good for actors to do that, because you know what? People like myself won't ever hire you again. Honestly, I adore actors, and most actors that have worked with me, and I, quite frankly, I'm not close to Randy and didn't know Randy that well because he was very distant from any of us, but I think it's appalling when an actor bites the hand that feeds them, and you can certainly use this. I have no qualms at all about it, and basically, at a point with the show, they had to call his people and say he is not allowed to do press anymore because he would literally trash the show and the character and the path of the show. So it was very unfortunate. So, you know, but the rest, I got to say, I mean, that cast was a dream cast.
In preparing for our interview, I read article after article that referred to openly gay writer Del Shores. So I asked Del about his default salutation.
Del Shores, openly gay writer-director, or openly gay writer-director Del Shores. And I'm really cool with being gay, and I love that I'm out, and it's okay if I'm the poster boy a little bit. But I don't really feel like that is all of the pie. You know, there's a lot more to me than just that. So sometimes it bothers me a little bit. And I got to tell you, our own community sometimes gets, like when I wrote The Trials and Tribulations of a Trailer Trash Housewife, I actually had people say, oh, well, you've betrayed us. There's nothing gay about this play. You know, I'd won the GLAAD Award for Southern Baptist Sissies. And the GLAAD committee called me and go, well, are you going to allot tickets for The Trials and Tribulations? I said, well, you know, it's not a gay play. And they were very upset at me. They felt like I had abandoned the community. But there are stories to tell that don't necessarily have to do with being gay. I mean, of course, Willa Dean had a gay son, and that was part of that. But I just write from... I'm a storyteller, first and foremost.
In Los Angeles, at the small 99-seat Zephyr Theater, squeezed between trendy shops on Melrose Boulevard, there's a repertory revival of all six Del Shores plays called A Season of Shores, featuring many of the original stars. Fans of his work are flying in from as far away as Germany, and the run is selling out almost as quickly as the next play is announced. For me, Southern Baptist Sissies hits hardest. It's the story of three boys growing up gay, in a church that condemns them, and in families that deny them.
I get more letters from gay men and gay women who have felt the torture and the pain, and they find this play very healing. And if that's all it does is heal some wounded hearts, then I'm really cool with that. But I got to tell you, when I was living in Sherman Oaks, across the street were some wonderful people who were Southern Baptist, and they came to see the play. I was so scared. I was going, oh my God, you know. They were the only ones on our block with a Bush Cheney sticker in their window. It was very small. Everybody else had very large boards, and it was almost like they were ashamed. And she called me after she saw it, and she said, I'm bringing my sons to see your play because I have taught them incorrectly.
This has been a conversation with Del Shores. For more information on Del, his website is delshores.net. For info on Season of Shores in Los Angeles, visit seasonofshores.com. And as always, for info on LGBT film, visit prideonscreen.com. This is Steve Pride. Thanks for listening.
There's a rage way down inside me. It's branded my soul. It leaves me as one of the many, with a hate so hard to control.
There's a time when we all must decide. Step on up with wisdom and power. And say, children, let's give up the fight. Oh, consider.
Thanks for tuning in to This Way Out, the International Lesbian and Gay Radio Magazine. This week, Sherry Lund, Charles Hall, Rex Walkner, Graham Underhill, Jerry Trowbridge, and Steve Pride contributed program material. Levi Christ sang Stained Glass Window, set to be heard in the upcoming movie Southern Baptist Sissies, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. Remember, you can listen online to This Way Out exclusively on planetout.com. There's also a link at our website, thiswayout.org. Some This Way Out operating expenses are funded by direct charitable donations from our listeners. Thank you. Log on to thiswayout.org to find out how you can help keep this program on the air and choose from some unique This Way Out queer history and culture CDs that you can own as our thanks. That's thiswayout.org. To sign up for our weekly emailed program information messages and or our monthly This Way Out updates, email tworadio@aol.com. You can also write to us at Post Office Box 38327, Los Angeles, California, 90038, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappell and all of us at This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon. We thank you for listening on CJAM Windsor, Ontario, Trans FM Broward County, Florida, KUGS Bellingham, Washington, and more than 150 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Stay tuned.
This Way Out is heard every week as part of Queer Voices. You are listening to 90.1 FM KPFT.
If you think HIV/AIDS is no longer a problem, think again. In Houston, every 8 hours, someone becomes infected with HIV. 1 in 90 Houstonians is HIV positive. There's still no cure, but you can protect yourself and others by getting tested and learning more about this deadly disease. You can help. Join AIDS Foundation Houston in the fight against HIV/AIDS on Sunday, March 12th for the 17th annual AIDS Walk Houston. With your participation, we can give thousands of men, women, and children a reason for hope. For more information about AIDS Walk Houston, call 713-403-WALK or log on to www.AIDSWalkHouston.org. This is commercial-free, listener-sponsored Pacifica Radio, KPFT, Houston.
Well, they didn't have the red carpet out for us today here at KPFT.
And there was no champagne?
No, no.
Or caviar? Or those gift bags with
we
all those...
We didn't have a parking space.
Really?
We had to step over bodies in the lobby just to get in.
The Academy Awards were yesterday, as was talked about on This Way Out, and I guess so many people expected that Brokeback Mountain would take the number one movie.
Like all the critics.
All the critics. Well,
well I
had won
heard
most
that,
of them.
That Crash had a chance
I
at
heard
it.
That too.
And
it's a very good film. No two ways about it. It has a very good message. As an all the movies that were nominated. I mean, this was an incredible year. Unfortunately, a lot of people didn't see a lot of these movies. But the whole, you know, Good Night, Good Luck. Crash was fabulous. Transamerica. I'm sure I'm forgetting Brokeback Mountain. Constant Gardner. And
I can't have any complaints about the people that won, except for the best song, because that simply wasn't the best song of the ones nominated, or any song. So,
well, I think it also has to do with how it fits in the film, and that's one film I didn't see, so I can't really say.
Yeah. Although it was a bad song. It's a disgrace.
But Ang Lee did get the best director of the year.
And he made a wonderful speech.
Yes, and there was actually
touching.
Sort of a montage of gay cowboys, supposedly, or what appeared to be gay cowboys in movies.
That was so
throughout.
Great, too.
It
that was clever, except they overdid it with the montages.
But that was the montage that worked.
Yes. Well, as Jon Stewart said, there's going to be a montage of montage.
Yeah.
And, you know, I know some people weren't that crazy about Jon Stewart doing it. I thought he was fine.
I thought he was okay. I wasn't really entertained the whole evening.
Well, and I think...
I thought he sucked.
they are more focused, I think, on the actual films and talking about the films.
We're going to give awards about the awards.
Lily Tomlin's speech.
Was very good.
Because it was very poignant to about the way Robert Altman does
films. It was about the category.
Yes, the layers of talking and stuff.
That was well done.
Well, and it was, of course, the Oscars were very, very gay yesterday. And it's nice. And, you know, people were saying, is Hollywood out of touch with America? More likely, is America out of touch with Hollywood?
That could be.
Hear, hear.
Well, Joan Devlin is joining us from Iowa.
Actually, no, tonight I'm in Minneapolis, Minnesota.
How about that?
Oh, so it isn't cold enough for you in Iowa.
No, it wasn't cold enough for me, and I had to make a trip to the Mall of America. And I have on the phone with me Gerald Clark, who is the author of Capote, a biography. And as you guys have probably already discussed, Philip Seymour Hoffman won the Academy Award for Best Actor for his role as Truman Capote in Capote, which was based on Gerald Clark's book. And Gerald, are you with us?
Yes, I'm here.
So how excited were you to see Philip Seymour Hoffman win the Academy Award last night?
Oh, I was very excited. I thought he deserved it. Absolutely. There were other good performances. I thought Heath Ledger was very good. But I thought Philip's performance was just superlative.
You coached him, is that correct? Because you assisted with the screenplay?
I talked to Philip. I talked to everybody involved at some length. The director, Bennett Miller, the scriptwriter, Dan Futterman, and Philip as well. Philip and they all came out to my house on Long Island. We had a long talk. I gave Philip some tapes I had made of interviews with Capote, and he asked lots of questions about things actors are interested in, such as did Truman, who was nearsighted, take off his glasses when he was at dinner, sitting at dinner? And I said, yes, he did. Things like that, small things.
Now, your book is out in paperback right now. It came out again in 2005 after the film, and it was originally published in 1988. Is that correct?
Yes, that's right.
Now, what made you write a biography of Truman Capote? What kind of gave you the idea to do that? Because you have written an amazing biography. It is over 600 pages long, and it basically starts with Capote's parents meeting and goes from there. What made you want to do this?
Well, simply because I was asked by a publisher if I would write a biography of Truman. I had been writing a series of articles on writers, profiles of writers in the early 70s, famous writers, very good writers like Nabokov and Allen Ginsberg and Gore Vidal and Truman. And when my article on Truman came out, a publisher called me and asked if I would write a biography, and I called Truman and asked him if he would cooperate. I knew him, of course, from interviewing him for the profile. And he thought for about 30 seconds, and he said, well, and that little baby voice of his, well, sure. And so off we went. I thought it would take about 2 years, and it took me 13.
And how difficult was it to get, because you got some amazing information, how hard was it to get some of the more personal information out of Truman Capote? I mean, was there anything he was kind of trying to hide, trying to dodge around? Or was
No.
it pretty open?
No, there wasn't anything he was trying to dodge around. He was very truthful with me. He told me that he would not respect me unless I told the whole truth. And I think he wanted his story to be told, and told well. And I don't think he was dodging about anything. Over a period of time, I became very close to him, and I think that was the secret, really.
How hard was it for you to get to that point? Did you guys kind of hit it off right away, or did it just sort of evolve over time, or was it a little bit of both?
Well, a bit of both. We did hit it off very well. Truman was a very friendly person with most people, and he was fun to be with. When he wasn't drinking too much, and when I started the book, he was not drinking too much. Truman was more fun to be with, to have lunch or dinner with, than anyone else I've ever met. He was just full of life, full of spark, full of zest. And he wasn't, he would tell wonderful stories, but he was not a monologuist. He would not dominate the conversation. He was genuinely interested in the person sitting across the table from him. And he would get you to tell more secrets than you thought you'd ever tell anybody in your life.
Now, tell us a little bit about, the book covers a wide variety of topics, as I said, but tell us a little bit about In Cold Blood, because essentially that was what made him famous, but it also kind of, the fame wasn't, it was a little difficult to deal with at times as well.
Well, Truman was actually famous before In Cold Blood. He had been famous from a very early age, from his early 20s, really. In Cold Blood sent him up to just another level of fame, a fame that no other writer really that I can think of has ever achieved in modern times. The fame of a movie star, a rock star, that was the fame he had after In Cold Blood, just incredible fame. It was a hard experience for him. It took about 5 years. It started at the end of 1959 when he read about the killings of the Clutter family in the New York Times, and it only ended with the execution of the two killers in April of 1965. He told me that the whole experience from beginning to end scraped him down to the marrow of his bones, and that it, in a sense, killed him. And I think it did. Destabilized him in a way. I think, as I look back on it, Truman had been walking a tightrope for most of his life because he had had a terrible childhood and lonely childhood, and he had conquered it. But as I look back, as I say, he was walking a tightrope, and the whole experience of In Cold Blood just knocked him off that rope. And he never really got up, never really recovered.
Now, when you wrote the book in 1988, well, actually when it came out in 1988, did you expect that, you know, some 15, 20 years later, there was going to be this film and that it was going to take off again, be reissued? I mean, did you ever expect anything like that to come of the book?
No, I had hopes, I will say that, but no, I never really expected that. And I give Dan Futterman, the screenwriter, the credit for that. He's the spark plug behind all this. It was his idea to come to me, and he pursued it, and he pushed it, and simply the fact that he was had been friends with Philip Seymour Hoffman and with Bennett Miller, the director, since they were teenagers. He knew Bennett from the age of 12, and he knew Philip from the age of about 16 or 17. And the fact that they were all three such great friends is really the reason this thing got off the ground, because it was a dubious project from Hollywood's standpoint, a story about a gay writer. You take that into a big studio, and they'd laugh at you.
But the movie was fairly successful. It's won the Academy Award. I have not read any bad reviews of it whatsoever. I mean, how did it feel to see your book go on screen like that?
Oh, it was marvelous. I'm one of the few writers who are very happy with what they've seen on screen. Dan had to take a few liberties for dramatic reasons, which he really had to do. I understand that very well. I know I've been involved with films a long time, writing about them for many, many years. And I did not want him, or did not expect him, to be slavish to the book. In other words, he had to leave out a few characters. He had to compress time and do things like that. But the movie, nonetheless, is essentially true to what was happening in Kansas, what was happening to Truman. Most important, what was happening to Truman. The dilemma he was in while he was working on that book. He became very friendly with the two killers.
Right.
He didn't excuse what they had done. He knew they were killers. He didn't want them to get out of jail by any means. But he did become friendly with them. They wrote him, and I have all their letters to them, and there are many, many letters. And they Perry Smith, one he was more friendly with, used to call him Friend Truman, things like that. And Truman sent them little presents and books that they asked for and drawing paper so they could, because they both wanted to draw and become artists. And he was friendly with them, genuinely friendly with them. But yet he wanted them dead. He wanted them to be executed so he could finish his book. It was a terrible, terrible moral dilemma. He was a devilish situation for him.
It doesn't sound awful. Now let's talk about the book. We're talking to Gerald Clark, author of Capote, a biography. First of all, let's talk about the response to the book when it initially came out, and then this recent reissue of the book. What has the response been?
Well, terrific both times, I have to tell you. I don't want to blow my horn too loudly, but there were a few negative reviews first time around, but basically it got very nice reviews, and it was translated into 8 or 9 languages and did pretty well overseas. And the reissue has been doing very well, and it's being reissued in other countries as well, Britain and Sweden, Italy, Germany, Spain, and other countries have come on, like Poland and Slovakia, places like that. It's even gone into Japan. So I'm very pleased.
Do you think as I was reading it, my thought was that this would be an absolutely wonderful book for like high school and college English classes. Have you had any interest from those?
They haven't really come to me. I was on being interviewed by a station in Minneapolis the other day, and someone there said that she had given it to her high school students. I think it would be useful in a journalism class because Truman was a journalist much of the time, and I think it might be useful to students studying journalism and seeing what it's really all about. You get that very well in the movie. Some of the reviewers have thought that Truman was cold-blooded and Machiavellian and manipulating these two killers. Which he did to a degree, but any reporter does that. But I myself don't hold any of that against him because I think if I were in that position, what would I do? And I think, or any journalist, and I think you'd do pretty much the same thing he did.
John, I hate to interrupt, but we're running out of time.
Okay, let me get one quick question in. How can people get the book?
It's in the bookstores, it's on Amazon .com and BarnesandNoble.com, and you can go to my website. I have a website, GeraldClark.com, and you can order it through that if you want.
Great. Thank you so much. We've been talking to Gerald Clark, author of Capote, a biography on which the Academy Award-winning film Capote was based. I highly recommend the book. It is probably the most definitive biography of Truman Capote you will ever read. And, Gerald, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to be with us tonight.
Thank you. I've enjoyed it.
And you are listening to Queer Voices on KPFT Houston.
This is Queer Voices.
Well, that was really great of Joan to be able to do that interview. And how timely.
Very timely. This is Jennifer Renee. On Friday, March 10th at 11 a.m. at Bering Methodist Church, 1440 Herald, the Houston GLBT Behavioral Health and Wellness Coalition will hold a conversation about therapeutic issues related to gender identity. Presented by Kristen Benson, exploring relationships of transgendered people and how counselors can best support their clients. Kristen is a PhD candidate in marriage and family therapy at Virginia Polytechnic Institute and State University in Blacksburg, Virginia. She's down here with the Family Therapy Program of Houston University of Houston, Clear Lake. I had a remarkable and interesting meeting with this 20-year-old something dynamic therapist. She's a self-defined feminist lesbian and is currently working with married couples and sex. I thought that was very interesting. Her passion and her PhD studies are concerning transgender relationships in the immediate family, extended family, and friends and coworkers. The purpose of the meeting on Friday at Bering Methodist Church is to get real information to therapists on gender family relations. The Coalition is a network of health professionals to promote better informed GLBT care. The main thrust of the talk about gender variance and acceptance, it's about fixing it. But it's not about fixing it, but moving to real relationships and understanding. Disclosure of being transgender or gay is the most difficult issue for the individual and all members of the family. The individual's fear being out on their own or thrown out of the only home they've known, many just keep from saying any word and hiding until they're independent. No one wants to be a throwaway. Transgenders need to be able to come to a therapist for relationship counseling and know that the therapist has the knowledge to help families who seek understanding and accommodation. There are three primary tasks therapists who wish to be prepared for their clients need to be familiar with. One, being familiar with GLBT resources and organizations, develop an understanding of GLBT lexicon, avoid accidental negative or derogatory language. This will make the client and the family more at ease. Two, recognize that the clinical work is twofold, the reactions and feelings of the parents and the client. Three, the therapist must be aware of their own bias and create a safe environment for all members of the family. Now, to learn more and become better informed about these issues, come on Friday to Bering Methodist Church, 1440 Herald, 11 a.m. For information, you can call 713-526-1017. I'm planning on being there, and so should you.
Thank you, Jennifer. That sounds like a very interesting program.
I want to congratulate the Grand Marshals for 2006.
I do, too, especially since I nominated one of them.
Yes. And
that would be?
Well, that would be Phyllis Fry as female Grand Marshal. And Ray
she
Ramirez.
She hasn't been Grand Marshal yet?
No, she hasn't.
Well, it's way overdue.
Ray Ramirez as male Grand Marshal. Bunnies on the Bayou as the organization. And Reverend Marilyn Meeker Williams from Bering is the honorary Grand Marshal.
Way to go. So maybe we'll have some of those folks on in the near future on Queer Voices. And
I'm sure we will as we get closer to the Pride. And remind you that the AIDS Walk is this weekend, Sunday, March 12th, and you can sign up at AIDSWalkHouston.org.
Where is the walk?
It is
at Sam Houston Park is where they're stepping off, and there's all kinds of activities. The Pride Band is going to be there playing at the fountain. And
if you need an address, it's 1000 Bagby Street. And who do we have coming up next year, Deborah?
Next year?
Next year.
I don't know, but I have coming up tomorrow.
What about next week?
On Queer Voices, we will have...
Are we going to have Barney Frank?
We will have Jennifer Renee with an interview with Congressman Barney Frank. We'll have a fascinating discussion about the meaning of sex and gender with Janelle T. Alice McCarthy, Director of Community Relations at Rothko Chapel, will talk about the Religion Lecture Series program on March 15th called The Struggle for Truth, Voices from the Margins, which is with four gay theologians. And we'll talk with the folks at Project Excite about their program for GLBT youth at Bering. And our friend Nancy Ford, the new editor at the Houston Voice, will join
us. Which we broke last week.
She will join us to tell us about the latest adventures in her life, plus This Way Out music and the latest in community news here on Queer Voices.
I am so excited.
Wow. I know you are.
The Kristen Benson I mentioned in the report, she is the coordinator of the Excite Youth
Project. Excite.
And I think that brings us just to the end of the show, or very close to the end of the show. We want to thank all of our guests tonight, including Joan Devlin's interview with Gerald Clark. And Maria Gonzalez and Garnett Coleman, the election is tomorrow between 7 a.m. and 7 p.m. You can find out more information at hglbtpc.org.
And good luck to Diana Fernandez and the pageant for the Lone Star Volleyball Classic.
And thanks to David Elliott in Washington.
Yes, who keeps us up to date on what's going on up there. So,
thanks to all of us.
Yes.
Thanks for being there. Thanks for listening.
We have how much time, Glenn? 1 minute.
Oh my gosh, we can BS
How about
more?
Those Packers?
Well, remember everybody who pledged to KPFT to fulfill
you.
Your pledge.
Thank everyone.
If you need some more information, you can call us during business hours when we won't be here at 713-526-4000.
You can still pledge, right?
You can always pledge.
Yes.
I go to the website.
Yeah, April 15th is the Houston Transgendered Unity Banquet at the West Chase Hilton Hotel. If you want tickets to it, it's www.HoustonTransgenderUnity.org.
Who's going to appear?
Marcy Bowers from Trinidad. She's a doctor that took over from Dr. Biber after Dr. Biber passed away last
month. Just a couple
month.
Weeks ago, yeah.
Yes.
And I understand that there's something important happening tomorrow?
It's an election.
A primary election, go vote.
Yes, if you are paying attention, Glenn, we would have said you go to vote between 7 a.m. and 7 p.m.
Yes, I was paying attention.
At
this is for the recap,
place.
Though, you know.
Mm-hmm. It's worth repeating. What are you talking about?
You have been listening to Queer Voices, heard each Monday at 7 p.m. here on KPFT, a publicly funded Pacifica Network station. Queer Voices is produced live in Houston with recorded segments from This Way Out, which is produced at KPFK in Los Angeles. Queer Voices executive producer is Jack Valensky. On-air voices are Glenn Holt, J.D. Doyle, Deborah Bell, and Jack Valensky, with remote correspondents Joan Devlin in Iowa and David Elliott in Washington, D.C. For more information about guests, events, and organizations mentioned in the show, visit queervoices.org. Some of the music you heard is listed or available on J.D. Doyle's website, queermusicheritage.org. Be sure to listen every Saturday morning at 1 a.m. for After Hours with Jimmy Carper. It's Queer Radio with Attitude. This is listener-sponsored and commercial-free Pacifica Radio, KPFT, at 90.1 FM, 89.5 FM Galveston, and worldwide via streaming audio from kpft.org. For Queer Voices, I'm Glenn Holt.
Mark International Women's Day on March 8th. On all continents, women, often separated by national boundaries, ethnic, linguistic, cultural, economic, and political differences, come together on International Women's Day. This tradition represents decades of struggle for equality, justice, peace, and development. On Wednesday, March 8th, from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m., KPFT will present a locally produced special for International Women's Day. All five Pacifica stations will be celebrating this historic day. KPFT's International Women's Day special will feature music, culture, topical discussions, and more. Again, that's Wednesday, March 8th, from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. KPFT will preempt its regular programming for an International Women's Day special. This is commercial-free, listener-sponsored, Pacifica Radio, KPFT Houston. Want to volunteer to help produce the world's oldest and largest art car parade? Meet Orange Show staffers, returning volunteers, and sign up to join the fun on Tuesday, March 7th from 5:30 to 7 p.m. at Rudyard, 2010 Wall Street, at the Volunteer Recruiting Party.
Whether you skate, take pictures, make...
The free program you just heard was paid for by the listener members of KPFT Houston.
If you're not already a KPFT member, we encourage you to join with us in keeping free speech alive by becoming one. Basic membership is still $35 a year. You don't have to, but you'll feel better. Thanks for listening.